Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Catherine Whittaker, originally from Putney, but currently at the Foro Italico in Rome, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
So yes, for the first time ever, we have Catherine Whittaker introducing the tennis podcast. You might wonder what on earth is going on. We haven't completely run out of intros. Catherine, however, has decided to take part in the intros for the first time ever because I requested that not only she, but every single person in our database do so when I sent out what was meant to be an email to about 60 people, and it was received by several thousand. And I was requesting, Matt, those that have paid to become an intro friend of the Tennis Podcast and therefore be able to introduce a show like Catherine did just then, I asked them to send theirs in. It turns out I sent it to rather too many people. So that's what's been happening today. Let's be honest, Matt, it's been a bit of a day generally, hasn't it? And we've had the news that Rafael Nadal isn't playing Roland Garros. I'm not trying to put those two things side by side because that's rather a more important news story. And not only is he not playing Roland Garros this year, he's sadly at the end stages of his career. We're going to talk about that at length in this podcast. We'll get Catherine's take from Rome, but it has been a bit of a day.
It has, yes. The intro saga has provided some much needed levity to the day, and it was a very weird hour where my phone was blowing up with lots of people emailing us. And David, you were on a call at the time, weren't you? So you were unaware of your mishap for about 45 minutes or so, and then got a text from you when you'd finished that meeting. Oh, shit.
Yes, those were my precise words. And I very quickly sent an apology and a clarification as to what I'd done.
Yes, you did. You did very good recovery work. But yes, no, it has been a pretty heavy day, hasn't it? I think we've sort of had some practice over the last year or so with days like this, with Serena first and Federer shortly after. But in a way, those were more sudden. They sort of dropped their news suddenly, didn't they, on social media or Vogue magazine for Serena, whereas we were braced for today because we had 24 hours warning or so that there was going to be a press conference. And yeah, I sort of had a pang of anxiety about me sort of all day leading up to that press conference and what would Nadal's news be? We assumed it wasn't going to be particularly positive and that was the case. So yeah, a sad day, a heavy day, the sort of once again an end of an era feeling to it. Just a lot of emotions.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll be talking about those emotions. We'll be going through what Nadal had to say today and talking more generally about this, what this means for the sport, what it means for him, how we'll remember him. And we'll hear from Catherine Whittaker, who's not with us right now because she's over in Rome covering the event for Amazon Prime. But we have got Catherine's views on the subject, so we'll be playing those for you in just a moment. Matt referenced Roger Federer's retirement at the end of last year and his final event being the Laver Cup. And just before we get underway to talk about Rafael Nadal, I mean, one photo I dug up today, my mind instantly went to, was of Nadal and Federer sitting side by side at the Laver Cup. And it was really, you know, it did bring it all back to me. Just what a moment that was, and how important that felt. Just on the subject of Laver Cup, before we get underway with the full breakdown of what Nadal said today, should remind you that this edition of the Tennis Podcast is brought to you in association with On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. And On Location provides packages via Steve Fergal's international tennis tours to all of the four Grand Slam tournaments, including the US Open, which is on sale now. And this was my segue, folks. They have brilliant packages to the Laver Cup in Vancouver, which takes place the 22nd to the 24th of September. We can offer Tennis Podcast listeners a 5% discount to the Laver Cup weekend. So go to toursfortennis.com/podcast. That's tours, the number four, tennis.com/podcast. Click the Laver Cup discount section and enter the code Vancouver, VANCOUVER, when you purchase an eligible 2023 Laver Cup travel package on the official website of On Location. That's onlocationexp.com. You've got until the 31st of May to do so at 11:59 Eastern Time. The discount does not apply to the Rocky Mountaineer train tour package for the Laver Cup. You can only use the code Vancouver once, and it can't be used with other discounts or on previous purchases. You'll see your savings when you add an eligible package to your cart and use the code at checkout. This offer does not apply to hotel packages or other events from Steve Fergal's international tennis tours or On Location and its subsidiaries. If you have any questions, email info@toursfortennis.com. See onlocationexp.com's purchase policy for more information. So Matt, it was 4 o'clock local time in Spain. It was the Rafael Nadal Academy that this press conference was being staged at. Nadal walked in white t-shirt. He sat on a single stool. There was nobody with him other than the assembled media and the audience that were there. But the moment he walked out, and bear in mind, we did not know at this point why Nadal was holding a press conference. We'd heard from his PR manager yesterday that he would be giving a press conference, and it said only at that time would he reveal his plans for Roland Garros. And we had had some stories. There'd been a story in the Spanish media that he wasn't going to play Roland Garros, but this message came through from his team just moments afterwards saying, hold your horses, he's going to give a press conference. It's going to be tomorrow at 4 local time at his academy. And we found out today that it would be live streamed, so we were able to watch it. But the thing that immediately took my eye was that Carlos Moya, his longtime coach, and Carlos Costa, his manager for many years, both sat right on the front row looking at Nadal. And I did think at that point, okay, this feels more than just withdrawing from a tournament. Even though withdrawing from Roland Garros is a big deal, this felt big. And I was very fortunate at that point that I was in touch with Matt, because unsurprisingly, Rafa started speaking in Spanish immediately, and I did not understand a word. And I was in charge of our Twitter account trying to relay the news to our followers, but Matt was able to help me. And Matt, what did he have to say?
Well, he was able to help me as well, because yes, I do speak Spanish, but trying to tune into that Spanish and translate it to you via WhatsApp is not always that easy. And he sort of gave quite a handy, too long, didn't read summary notes at the end of his first speech, where he sort of summed up his three main points. And those were, number one, he's out of Roland Garros in a couple of weeks' time. He used the word impossible for him to go to Roland Garros. He made another point that he's stopping all tennis activity, training, practice for a few months. He's not able to say whether that's 1.5 months or 4 months, but it's a period of inactivity in order to hopefully recover and get over this hip injury that he's had all year since he sustained it at the Australian Open, because the methods that he's been using just haven't been working. That injury has not healed. One idea that he has is to maybe try and return at the Davis Cup at the end of the year, was something that he mentioned, but it was, you know, by no means sure at this stage, because he simply doesn't know how this period of inactivity will help him. And then the third point is that his plan is for 2024 to be his last year on tour. If he is able to make a recovery from the injury and get out and be competitive again, he plans to do that in 2024, and for that most likely to be it. So, you know, three big points there, three big announcements. He sort of expanded on some of those points and fleshed out some of his answers in Spanish, in Catalan, and in English. It was about a 45-minute press conference in total. And one thing that he really emphasized was just how much he's been struggling since the pandemic. You know, how difficult it's been for him to get his body ready, to be fit repeatedly since the pandemic. And I think as much as this is a physical break that he's taking now, and he said that it's been, you know, it's been a decision that's been made for him by his body, you know, I think it's also a bit of an emotional break, because he said it's been really tough mentally for him, for those around him, his friends, his family, his coaches, to be constantly working so hard and just keep having these setbacks. And it's sort of not fair on him, it's not fair on all those people around him, and he's just reached the point where he needs to stop. He can't take it anymore, both physically and I think emotionally. He said that if you're winning, all that sacrifice doesn't matter quite so much, because there's some reward at the end of it. But there's just been no reward over the last year or so, as he's tried to get back on court so desperately. So I thought that was a really interesting point. And then he was asked towards the end of the press conference why he wants to come back at all. You know, why not just stop now? And I think his answer to that was so insightful into him as a person. And he said, first of all, and he was a little bit shy about saying this, he sort of didn't really want to say it because it maybe made him sound a bit big-headed. I don't think it does, but he said he doesn't feel like he deserves to finish his career just giving a press conference. He said he feels like he's worked too hard, he deserves so much more than that, and he wants to get out on court and have a proper send-off that sort of is more fitting for his career. And he said it's always worth giving a little bit more. And he said that has been his philosophy throughout his career, his sort of life philosophy. That's his approach to everything. That's his approach to this. And he said if his body allows it, he has some faith that his tennis will make it worth the effort, because he thinks he's still playing great, great tennis. It's just his body isn't able to take him out onto the match court. So a fascinating press conference. I thought he handled it brilliantly. There were some sort of heartbreaking lines in there, but also some sort of heartwarming ones as well, in true Nadal style, I suppose.
Yeah, it must be hard for him to take, as I sensed witnessing the reaction to his announcement out there on social media and in people I spoke to. It's hard for people to take, I think, just the same way as it was when Serena Williams announced she was going to stop, and Roger Federer. These are people that have been ever present in the lives of so many people. Matt and I will talk some more about Rafael Nadal's announcement in a few minutes, but let's hear from Catherine out in Rome, first of all. She's there, she's on site. We can get a little bit of insight as to what it's been like there for her. And also hear her reaction to this news from Rafael Nadal. Here's Catherine.
Hello, Tennis Podcast team and listeners. You find me at the Foro Italico, where I'm just walking past the statues of the Pietrangeli court on my way from recording highlights links to the green room. Had to record two versions of the goodbye link to cover us in the event of rain, because that has been a major feature of my time here in Rome so far. It has been so wet and so cold, and undoubtedly those factors have had a big impact on the tennis that we've seen so far. And I found that pretty interesting, actually, seeing how players can adapt technically and mentally. I think it's quite a challenge to go out there knowing it's just going to be a slog. You know, to try and hit through the court in these conditions is a real challenge, I think, and you need to be pretty agricultural to be able to do that. So yeah, I found it very interesting what we've seen so far. Obviously today for us on air, aside from the matches that we've been covering, has been very much dominated by the Nadal news, which I'm quite sure you two are covering in brilliant detail. Obviously we had the tip off yesterday that he was calling a press conference today, so that, you know, it wasn't certain what he'd be announcing, but it was pretty clear to me, I think, that, you know, 99% chance he'd at the very least be announcing that he wouldn't be playing Roland Garros. So I had that time to prepare. But nonetheless, I kind of feel two things. I feel surprise at the announcement of his intention to play a goodbye year on tour, or his hopes to play a goodbye year on tour. I'm not sure I necessarily expected that from him. We've only really seen one man kind of officially do that, and that was Stefan Edberg, and he said he ended up regretting it, didn't he? And I'm sure, given that that happened in the 90s, David will give us all the background on that. But I do find it very interesting that Nadal has signaled that his intention to do that. I do wonder if his plan to do that is contingent on him being competitive. I find it hard to see him doing that if he's just rocking up and waving and losing in the first round at places. I just don't think it's in his DNA to tolerate that, just as it wasn't in his DNA to play Roland Garros this year, just to play Roland Garros. He obviously became aware that he wasn't able to be competitive. I do think that line he gave about players coming and going but tournaments staying forever is just the most Nadal line ever. I think it was his version of tennis, I love you and I'll never leave you. You know, it was his way of saying, as he has done at so many pivotal moments in the sport's recent past, that, you know, okay, I've been a big part of this sport for a little while and I've contributed to its history, but no player is bigger than the sport. And kind of, you know, men's tennis will be just fine kind of thing. And Nadal's always been great at that perspective. So yeah, it's emotional. It's emotional just as Federer's retirement was, because it's a marker of time passing, isn't it? Because Nadal has been a feature of almost all of my tennis watching life. So, you know, I do feel like the end of an era cliches really do apply. And he is probably, I think, in terms of in-person tennis watching experiences, he's given me more than anybody else. You know, I, as discussed on a recent Friends pod, I wasn't present for any of Andy Murray's Grand Slam victories or for Emma Raducanu's at the US Open, but I was there for Nadal winning the Australian Open last year and then winning the French last year and beating Daniil Medvedev in the 2019 US Open final. You know, I feel like he has given me so much as a tennis fan and viewer. And for that reason, I feel quite sentimental and sad and emotional. You know, I'm ready for it. I certainly am not somebody that wants to see Rafael Nadal struggling and not being competitive at Roland Garros. So there's an element of relief there, but I will miss him so much. I really will. I think I feel more sort of real sadness than I did when Federer had retired, because I felt like Federer had ceased to be a factor in conversation somewhat before his actual retirement, whereas I feel Nadal has been, you know, up until Australia this year, he was right at the top of our conversation lists in terms of mixes. But I wonder if Nadal will ever be in a mix again. And on that melancholy note, I will hand back to you both, and I will look forward to joining you on the show on Sunday to wrap up the week in Rome, which I hope weather-wise is going to take a turn for the better.
That is a sobering thought, isn't it? That Rafael Nadal may never be part of what we call the mix at a tennis tournament. And let's be honest, he was in the mix for any tennis tournament that he entered for the last 18 years, something like that. And it's a little bit like when we were covering the life and career of Nick Bollettieri last week for Friends of the Tennis podcast, where even though I met him for the first time in his 80s and he died aged, I think, 91, it felt like he would go on forever. It felt like he would never run out of gas. And in terms of their careers, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Serena Williams, you kind of, even though you know, logically speaking, of course they have to stop playing tennis one day. They can't play this level. They can't play professionally. I mean, you know, sometimes I look at Nadal walk around and I think, I hope in 20 years' time you're able to do social tennis, because he's put his body through so much over the years. But even though you know that logic, it's really hard to grasp that kind of this is it. Maybe he could get that one more year, but basically this is it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be bizarre having a Roland Garros without Rafael Nadal. I mean, I literally do not know Roland Garros without Rafael Nadal. That will be true for a lot of people. Our friend Charlie Equicher said that Nadal playing and winning Roland Garros has been the axis on which the tennis world turns, were his words. And I think that sums it up perfectly. There's just been this continuity, this grounding, this familiarity about Nadal at Roland Garros. And he's just been a universal law there, I suppose, of tennis. He will show up at Roland Garros and he will most likely win the thing. And we're going to be in Paris in a week's time and Rafael Nadal's not going to be there. But like going to Paris and the Arc de Triomphe not being there. It's going to be very, very strange, I think, not to hear the on-court announcer listing out all of those Roland Garros titles, which is such a favourite moment of every season. And, yeah, I mean, the last time Nadal missed Roland Garros was 2004, and that was because of a foot injury. So there's kind of a sort of full-circle moment that here he is again having to miss it because of his body. I think probably more than any of the all-time greats, Nadal's, you know, one of Nadal's biggest opponent, maybe his biggest, has always sort of been his own body. And I think he's won that battle. He's gone on a lot longer than anyone probably ever thought. And yet here we are, and he is sort of announcing the end. So yeah, there's the short term, contemplating just the next month or so without Nadal at Roland Garros. And then there's the long term. What will this farewell tour be like? I'm not sure. Not sure I'm emotionally ready after one event of Serena and two events of Serena and one event of Federer last year. It was a lot to take. If we're getting that every single event next year, it's going to be a lot. And yeah, then of course, there's two trips to Roland Garros next year because the Olympics are also at Roland Garros, which adds an extra element of intrigue, I suppose, to next year. But yeah, you're right. They've been such integral parts of our lives. It's very hard to contemplate them not being around, and Nadal joining Serena and Federer in retirement soon is just a sad thing to think about.
Mm. Yeah, as inevitable as it is, it's always going to be sad. He explained himself very well as to why he's going to go on this farewell tour. But as Catherine alluded to, I do have experience of watching another incredibly popular sports person in Stefan Edberg going on one of those tours in 1996 when he finished his playing career. And every week that he played tennis, there was a presentation to him. There was, people wanted to show him how much they loved him. And it was a very understated thing by comparison with Edberg. Everybody loved him, but it was still nothing like it will be with Nadal. Nothing like. And if he were to be able to play a proper full year of some 10 or 15 tournaments even, he's going to be exhausted by that, I think, because that's what Edberg said he was, and actually when I had a chance to interview Stefan Edberg back in 2020 when we were in the middle of the pandemic and doing all of our Tennis Relived shows, the sort of original ones, and he told me if he was advising Roger Federer, who was the next player we expected to retire, whether to do a farewell tour or not, he would advise him not to. And I found that very interesting at the time. And look, it's horses for courses. You do what you think is right for you. And there's no right or wrong when it comes to retirement. And all I hope is that Nadal gets his chance to get out there on the court again, but not just for a farewell tour. I want him to be competitive. I want him to be able to play the greatest hits a little bit out there and show what he was all about for all those years, because there was a frisson when he walked out onto the court. There was an electricity. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it, just saying those words. He gives me goosebumps when he walks out onto a stadium court and waves with one hand and then raises his racket with the other to the crowd. There was nothing like it. And I hate saying that in the past tense, but at the moment it feels like the past tense. I really hope he gets one more chance, at least one more chance on a big stage to come out and be Rafael Nadal again. And then to unleash that game of his, which improved so much over the years, didn't it? Because, you think of the bulging biceps and the calf-length trousers and the whipped forehands and hooking them cross-court and thrashing them down the line. And then the rest of the stuff that he added to his game over the years, it really was something to witness in its entirety, to think about where he came from as a great player, as a truly great player, even at the start, because of his athleticism and his tenacity. But then the individual elements that he added, I want to see them all again, Matt.
Yeah, well, for the time being, I will point you in the direction of YouTube. and then we'll just have to cross our fingers for 2024, as you say. Yeah, and I think you've mentioned it there. Catherine mentioned it in her voice note. In-person Nadal experiences, I think, were probably the most impactful, I suppose. The energy in the stadium changed when he took to the court. You felt the fizz and the power on his shots, I think, in the stadium in a way that maybe didn't always come through on TV. And, yeah, I mean, I personally, I don't know if I would be into tennis if it wasn't for Rafael Nadal. I might have found the sport some other way, but I know for sure that I found it because of Rafael Nadal. And I wore three-quarter length trousers the first time I ever went to Wimbledon. You know, Nadal was really my guy. And when I was, you know, 10, 11 years old, I just thought he was the coolest. And then to now be reporting on the sport and having, you know, witnessed some epic moments from Nadal as recently as last year, you know, the miracle in Melbourne when he won that Australian Open title will always stay with me. And by that point, there was this fragility to him. You know, we sort of knew he was hanging on. He was sort of fighting his own body. And yet he still came out and played the most ferocious tennis with those added layers that you spoke about of the sort of the way he developed his game and so intelligently. And yeah, he was the king of clay, but also he won, you know, so many titles on hard court, and he adapted his game to grass as well. He's a true great, and I really, really hope, as you said, that we get to see some of that magic again next year.
I loved that ambition that he had to improve, to be everything on a tennis court, and not to just be the king of clay. I mean, and this is a guy who won 14 French Opens, and look, he may still next year win a 15th. Well, who knows?
Well, that's it. He has at least for this year made us avoid that awkward question of, is Nadal the favourite for Roland Garros, even though he's not had any matches in the last 5 months? But I feel like we might be going through that question again next year if he's in the draw, because you would not write him off if he is at least capable of playing and with the surge that the crowd could give him. I mean, Serena played her best tennis in her comeback, didn't she, knowing it was her last event? You know, if Nadal knew it was his last Roland Garros, can you imagine the force with which he would come out if he's able? So, yeah, I really, really hope that's in our future.
Yeah. And, well, I hope he has some pain-free months ahead of him, because he's clearly just had to live with so much pain out on the practice court and persevering all this time. And, you know, he's lost a lot over the years to injury. I mean, he's been playing 18, 19 years on the circuit, which is absolutely staggering in itself. And he's won all these titles, but he's had to put up with a lot. And mentally, that must have been really tough. And I think I did sense just a bit of relief, really, in him having made this decision. You know, it's a difficult thing to have to do. Everybody has to do it if you play at that level. And this was his time. But I do love that he's leaving the door ajar and he's going to give it one last swing and see what he might be able to do. And I really do hope he manages to play Davis Cup at the end of the year. I mean, that would be incredible, wouldn't it? That's something to think about. And also, as you say, the Olympics next year. I mean, crikey, just imagine if he was able to get out there and be competitive. I like to dream. But whatever happens, Rafael Nadal has brought us a lot. And we're going to get to hear a little bit more about Rafael Nadal in the company of our good friend Christopher Clary at the end of this show, who has been writing about Nadal for many decades for the New York Times, and he's got a bit of news related to him as well. So we'll have that for you in a little while. But first of all, let's just concentrate on what's gone on in Rome so far, Matt, because, I mean, it is, you know, had Rafael Nadal not announced all this, we'd have spent very comfortably a good 40 minutes talking about what's gone on in Rome, because it has been pretty eventful, including the defeat of Carlos Alcaraz in just his second match.
Yes, I'm not sure I feel qualified to talk about Rome, because if you'd said to me a few days ago that not one of Sinner and Alcaraz and Djokovic and Iga Świątek would have even made it to the semi-finals here, let alone, you know, the final even, I simply wouldn't have believed you. And, you know, you can see our predictions in the newsletter for the fact that that is the case, because we all just completely got this tournament wrong. It's been really intriguing to see it develop. And I'm sort of left wondering, David, what it all means. That is the question. That is the question that we so often come back to. But how much do I need to read into Carlos Alcaraz's defeat? How much does it matter that Novak Djokovic has lost to Holger Rune? How worrying is Iga Świątek's injury? I suppose time will tell and give us all those answers. But it does feel at the moment like we're a little bit in limbo. We don't really know what Rome means, but it has been incredibly eventful.
Yeah, it really has. And actually, I mean, you're being very kind, Matt, saying we've all got it wrong in the predictions, because there's no... I've got mine as badly wrong as I got my sending out the email to the intro backers earlier on today.
No, David, we have literally... You, Catherine, and I have all got 0 out of 8 on our Rome predictions.
What were we doing? We were predicting the quarterfinals onwards.
Semi-finals onwards, yeah.
Semi-finals onwards for both draws, and we got all of them wrong.
All of them wrong.
Right, okay. So if you'd like to know who we're going to be predicting in the future, do sign up to the newsletter, the Tennis Podcast newsletter. There's a link in your show notes, and you will get to find out who's not going to win tournaments, because that'll be whoever we have collectively picked. But, I mean, some are mine. Madison Keys. Wasn't Taylor Fritz one of mine? Went out in the 4-1 in his first match. I mean, honestly, I don't know why you're bothering, folks. I really don't. But anyway, I'm delighted you are with us. And, first of all, Carlos Alcaraz, we'll start with him, beaten by a man who, to say I knew very little about, would be the biggest understatement of the century, I think. But from Hungary, Fabian Morozsán, I mean, he was absolutely sensational. And I really don't say that lightly in this instance. The way he played from start to finish, he was out-dropping Alcaraz, out-drop-shotting him. He was out-hitting him from the baseline. And he showed nerve. And you're thinking, how is this guy ranked in the 130s doing this?
Yeah, there was a message from Catherine's brother on the WhatsApp group saying that Alcaraz is taking a bit of a rustling, and it was that feeling of like we had when Lucas Rossell beat Rafael Nadal at Wimbledon. Who is this guy, and how is he capable of playing?
Who is this guy?
Such brilliant tennis, and was this just one big purple patch, or is he actually that good? I think he's 23, isn't he? And there's always a reason, I suppose, why they haven't come through yet. But in this match, Morozsán was fantastic. As you said, his drop shots were amazing, way better than Carlos Alcaraz's, who I would have said had the best drop shot in tennis. He was completely fearless. He rushed Alcaraz. And in that respect, it was a little bit similar to the way Sinner rushes Alcaraz, and Struff managed to do it in Madrid as well. I think maybe there is a little bit of a template there. You've got to rush him. It's very hard to do. And Morozsán did it fantastically, getting his forehand into play, held his nerve at the end to close out the second set tiebreak. And it was pretty stunning. And yet at the same time, I didn't think Alcaraz would win Rome. I think maybe it might have been more damaging, or it would have changed in my mind how I saw him going into Roland Garros if he'd, lost to Djokovic there. I might have thought, oh, well, that means Djokovic has kind of got the edge over Alcaraz. But I don't know. It feels like, yes, Alcaraz has still got to sort of prove himself at Roland Garros. He didn't play brilliantly there last year. Rome conditions are similar to Roland Garros. He wasn't brilliant this year in Rome. Yeah, he's still got something to prove, but it doesn't really make me feel much less confident in Carlos Alcaraz going into Roland Garros. I still think he's in a pretty good place, really.
Mm. Yeah, and maybe the rest will do him a bit of good. I know kind of seemed to work against him last year. It got out of his timing a little bit. But I do think he's still got it all to prove, really, on this particular service in Rome and Roland Garros. conditions. We don't know yet. We don't know whether his game completely translates or if he knows exactly how to package it at that tournament just yet. So we'll have to wait and see. You're not that concerned about Alcaraz. Are you concerned about Novak Djokovic's chances based on the fact that he has been defeated by Holger Rune, who was fantastic, I should add. I thought he played the most brilliant match. What a player he is. He out-Djokovic'd him in many elements of the match. And it was a pretty grouchy Djokovic at stages of it as well, which is also a bit of a telltale of as to how much he was uncomfortable out there, I thought. Do you read much into that in terms of what it all means for Roland Garros, for either one of those two players, or do you take it in only in isolation?
Well, I think Holger Rune is probably going to be in my mix for Roland Garros, I would say.
That is big.
Even though he has it all to prove at Grand Slam level, it's just very difficult to ignore how good he is. And I think especially on clay, I felt like he'd had a little bit of a slow start to the season. I mean, fine, nothing to worry about. But I was waiting for the Holger Rune that we saw in Paris last year to emerge. And I think he's come to life on the clay. And he was absolutely brilliant against Novak Djokovic. He's one of those players, I think, who says things like, I want to be number one, and really, really means it, and I think really knows what it takes as well. I think he's an incredibly hard worker. He's incredibly dedicated to the sport, and I think he has a deep appreciation for how good he needs to be to get to the top. And a win against Novak Djokovic just helps him, you know, just sets it in his mindset, just gives him belief, just knows that he can do it. He loves playing big top players. He's won six matches in a row against top five players now. He thrives in that environment. So it sort of elevated my expectations of Rune, I suppose, at Roland Garros. For Djokovic, I really am torn, because such a big part of me is saying Grand Slams are different. They're a different beast. We know that. It's five sets. It's the main motivation for Djokovic. He'll be a different guy at Roland Garros. And I think I lean on that side. I don't think I'm too worried. But there were just some elements in Rome where normally that's the tournament where you expect him to start finding his best tennis on the clay. And he didn't quite. I'm still not sure he's 100% fit. There was some suggestion that the elbow was better, but I also saw him putting his towel behind his back at every change of ends and sort of stretching that out. I thought maybe he might be struggling slightly in the lower back. Before he played Norrie, he was in the treatment room right before the match, and he was very coy about not going into detail about what that was. And he came out really flat against Holger Rune, as though something was on his mind, as though something was sort of worrying him. He wasn't locked into the match in a way that I would expect from Djokovic at this point in the season, just before a Grand Slam. So all is not quite right, but there's so much evidence that Novak Djokovic can turn it on at a Grand Slam.
Yeah, and the additional element that you haven't mentioned there is that he won't have to face Rafael Nadal.
Indeed.
Who, of course, beat him at the tournament last year, despite the fact that Djokovic had come in on that great performance in Rome. And yet you have to remember that the last time he won Roland Garros, he didn't win Rome. In fact, he had a bit of a difficult time coming into that tournament. And this is something that I've seen a lot of times with Djokovic. He is the king of peaking, and he will sometimes just find it. I mean, it's not a question of flicking a switch, because if you could do that, you'd flick it all the time. But I mean, with him, he does sometimes just find his game, find his best at the perfect time, fourth round, quarterfinals, and then suddenly it's like, good luck everybody else, because he's still that guy. It's just that the way Holger Rune played him, it felt like he could deal with him. I know that wasn't best of five. That wasn't a Grand Slam tournament. Rune may not be able to find that at Roland Garros. He had a couple of niggles himself physically at times over the course of the week. Maybe he's not going to be the same player. He's not the sure thing that Novak Djokovic is, because we just don't have the evidence. I mean, he's 19. But my goodness, when he's on, he is playing like Novak Djokovic, which is an astonishing thing to be able to say. And he outdid the guy at his own game. And I really was bowled over by him. I mean, he's now going to face Casper Ruud. Very quick prediction for that, Matt. They played each other at the French Open last year. Ruud won it. We had the whole escapade at the end of the match where Ruud sort of shook his head. Ruud had been basically, I think he thought he was being a brat for his behaviour on court, and also the manner in which he shook his hand. And then we had the whole did he or did he not say yeah in Ruud's face in the locker room, which we believe he probably didn't say. But anyway, what do you think is going to happen in the rematch?
I think Holger Rune is going to get his first win over Casper Ruud. And it's hard sometimes to go against such a dominant head-to-head. It's for love to Casper Ruud. But they've not met since last year's French Open, the infamous Yar match that you reference. Rune's a much better player now, a year on, I think. And Ruud, this has been a good week for him in Rome. I think he needed this week. He needed to get some wins and back them up. I still don't think he's playing anywhere close to his best tennis. And I think Rune will have too much game for him. I'd be pretty surprised if Rune doesn't win that.
Wow, that's quite big. I think I might go Casper Ruud just to ensure that Holger Rune wins. I mean, I actually think Ruud, he's going to bring it. He's going to bring it full on. And I know he's not playing as well as he was a year ago. But I think there are still doubts about Rune when he goes out on a tennis court. You don't 100% know what you're going to get from the guy. I think he's been the player of the tournament so far. I think he's been the best player in that draw. Right from his first win over Artefis. I've seen all of his matches, and he's just been able to deal with any game style, including Alexey Popperin, who was absolutely blasting the ball at him. And then he beats Djokovic. I mean, come on. This is impressive stuff. We should also mention the aggro that we had between Novak Djokovic and Cameron Norrie the round before, where if you didn't see it, they had a little bit of an exchange of drop shots and so forth at the net. And then a sort of edged, I think it was an edged backhand up in the air from Djokovic trying to deflect the ball back over. And it just sort of popped up for a very easy put away at the net for Norrie. So Djokovic basically just turned his back, really, to concede the point and say, yeah, okay, I'm not going to win this, off I go. And then Norrie plays the smash full pelt into the ankle of Novak Djokovic, who'd got his back turned. Djokovic then turns slowly, dramatically, and for some period of time stared at Cameron Norrie, who gave him the briefest of apologies and turned his back and walked off back to the baseline. And when he got to the baseline, he would have turned around and seen Novak Djokovic still standing there staring at him. And it must have been, I mean, I'm not saying that Cameron Norrie was terrified, but I was on his behalf, because that was a man who was, you know, Djokovic is very prepared to congratulate, to engage with an opponent, and it to be all about sort of fair play when he's not stressed and when he's not angry. But when he does go, my word, he goes. And he was not happy at all with Cam Norrie. Do you think he was within his rights to not be happy, Matt?
Well, I thought Tamini Karyol of The Guardian put it well, saying he likes body shots and he likes death stares. So no notes, you know, I think I agree with that. I think Cameron Norrie was entitled to hit the ball there, and Djokovic was probably pretty entitled to be a bit annoyed about it, that Cameron Norrie had hit the ball there. I found the quotes afterwards from Novak Djokovic interesting, compelling. He didn't hold back in press. He was asked about it. And he actually made the point that he wasn't just annoyed at Norrie for tagging him on the ankle in that moment. He was actually annoyed about Norrie's behaviour generally, you know, saying that he was fist pumping come on in his face right from the very first point, and that he took a medical timeout right at the end of the match just as Novak Djokovic was about to serve for it. And Djokovic made the point, these are all perfectly legal things, but he said in his opinion they're not sort of fair play things, they're not how you treat other players. And I must say, I did sort of think a little bit of insert Daniil Medvedev voice, look at yourself in the mirror. I mean, Novak Djokovic has been known to be very pumped up from the start of a match and be fist pumping. He has been known to take medical timeouts at times where people might doubt him. And, you know, fine, all within the rules. And I just think Norrie was sort of trying to do everything he could, really, to make up the talent gap, make up the quality gap between him and Djokovic. He's got to do something. But yeah, I mean, Norrie sort of accidentally got himself involved in a lot of aggro, I think. This is not intentional, I don't think, from Cameron Norrie. He'd be one of the last players I would expect to be talking about in an aggro section on the podcast. But I must say,
you don't think he deliberately did it then?
I think he deliberately did the things to try and disrupt Djokovic, but I don't think he was expecting Djokovic maybe to be so annoyed and so outspoken about it all.
Oh,
I suppose.
Interesting.
But I must say, from a Djokovic perspective, you know, we've all watched him and observed him closely over the years. I felt like his reaction was really encouraging, because there's nothing worse than a Novak Djokovic who's flat and a bit sterile on the court. If Djokovic is getting a little bit triggered by something, if he's getting emotional about something, that's usually for him such a great sign. So I actually looked at that match and thought, wow, okay, this is now kind of the real Novak Djokovic coming out. That's why I was so stunned by how flat he was against Holger Rune in the opening set. I didn't expect that at all. So maybe that makes me think maybe there is still some sort of injury problem or something still on his mind, because it felt like that was the moment against Norrie where he was just going to go and he was just going to be locked into this tournament and playing his best tennis. But it didn't happen against Holger Rune.
Good points. So we now have Rune against Ruud. We also have Daniil Medvedev, who's got himself into the semi-finals. What is this about everybody doing their best stuff a week late? I mean, I picked Medvedev to win Madrid. He didn't get even to the semis. I picked Yelena Ostapenko to get to the semis, and she did nothing, and now she's in the semis. Little spoiler for what we're about to talk about, but anyway, I had to get that out of my system. So anyway, Medvedev is going to be up against Stefanos Tsitsipas, who's beaten Borna Coric in straight sets this evening, which is a good win for Tsitsipas, isn't it? I mean, I haven't actually had a chance to see that, but I mean, he's had a tough time against Borna Coric over the time, and it's been on while we've been chatting. But that's a very good win for him on paper, at least, and it's going to be these are great semifinals.
Oh, they are dreamy semi-finals from aggro enthusiasts as we are, because they all have history. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that is a big win for Tsitsipas. Coric has kind of had his number game-wise. I think when I've watched their matches, they've had a lot of backhand-to-backhand rallies, and Coric has come out on top. And he's also, I think, been in Tsitsipas's head with a lot of tight wins, sort of comeback wins. So big for Tsitsipas to get the win there. And he is not going to want to lose to Daniil Medvedev on clay. As improved as Medvedev is on the surface, this should still be Tsitsipas's territory. So that's absolutely fascinating.
Ordinarily, Matt, we would probably be leading with the fact that Iga Świątek has been beaten, not only beaten, but also suffered an injury of her own in her match against Elena Rybakina. She won the first set 6-2, did Świątek, and then Rybakina came back at her, won the second set on a tiebreak. It was a really good, compelling second set. And unfortunately, they both sort of avoided one another in terms of when they were playing at their very best tennis, I felt. I thought Świątek was dominant in the first set, and then Rybakina really started to find her way. And then we had this situation at, was it right at the start of the third set, or was it at the end of the second set, where Świątek was sliding all over the court, doing the most extraordinary lunges to get to balls, retrievals, and then she pulled up. And there was clearly an issue. At first, I thought she'd injured her knee, strained her knee, but the way she sort of stopped and stared at it, and it looked as though she was in tears as well during that period of, I imagine there's panic, there's fear, there's sadness as well as to, if it were to be serious, for instance, sometimes players know whether it's serious, don't they? But I think quite often in those sort of situations, they're just scared. They're just shocked, in shock. And there was a suggestion by commentators I was listening to that maybe she'd cracked her leg, her knee with the frame of the racket while she was trying to get to the ball and it just stung. But then it just became quite clear it was more than that and there was something wrong. Then she went off for a medical timeout and she got the top of her thigh heavily strapped. So it became apparent that it wasn't a knee problem at all. It was a thigh injury. And I did actually think in the early parts of the third set that she was sort of going to just try and play through it. And she played another four games. It got to two games all. And then she withdrew. But it looked as though she was going to try and play through it. Now, I mean, people went for me on Twitter because I said I didn't see any obvious signs that she was massively struggling. And I suppose what I mean is I wasn't expecting her to lose. Maybe I didn't phrase it that well, but sorry, I wasn't expecting her to retire at that point just because she still seemed invested in trying to find a way. And I don't cast any view on whether she should or shouldn't have done that. To my mind, she knows how she feels, and if she's scared and if she's upset and it's hurting, she should stop. You know, if that's how she feels in the moment, no issue at all with that. But that's kind of why I reacted in that way. But she's since gone and had a scan. And they're doing what she called on Twitter diagnostics to try to work out the extent of the problem. And she said she'll update people in the next few days. But that was a worrying moment, wasn't it? When somebody like her, who's as athletic as she is and seemingly as flexible as she is and rarely seems to have problems like that, when she pulls up like that, it does shake you, especially given her status in the game.
Yeah, and especially given the proximity to Roland Garros, where, you know, if she's fit, she's going to be a big favourite there. Yeah, absolutely. As you said, she immediately looked pretty worried. Shock, pain, I suppose, the combination of the two. And yet, as you said, her retirement was just quite sudden in that third set. Her movement was certainly compromised, but she was still swinging away. But absolutely, no point in risking it just before Roland Garros. And it was a shame because I was really enjoying the match. You know, kind of, it was so intriguing. How would Rybakina's dominance over Świątek this season translate to clay? And initially it looked like Rybakina's comfort in the matchup had been usurped by Świątek's comfort on the surface. And Świątek was brilliant in that first set. There were so many moments where she was lining up a ground stroke and she's got that thing where she can get such late dip on the ball. You don't know when the ball's in midair, whether it's going in or out. And there's a split second where sort of everyone's holding their breath, even Świątek. And it would just invariably drop in and you would get this huge reaction from Świątek. And I loved watching those sorts of rallies. But Rybakina was really, really gritty, you know, down a set and a break. She kept herself in the match, kept herself in the rallies. And we're now at a stage where Iga Świątek has not been able to put Rybakina away in a match this year. It feels to me like the way Rybakina produces her strokes and produces her power causes Świątek a lot of problems. And as the match went on, Rybakina found that even on the clay. So it does make it fascinating. Fingers crossed Świątek is 100% fit and healthy for Roland Garros. But if they were to meet there, I would have Świątek, I think, as the favourite. But in the back of my mind, knowing that she hasn't quite been able to finish Rybakina off this season, I think would be significant. And I think Rybakina will take a lot of confidence from that second set, the way she was able to hang with Świątek on clay in those conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And, well, we hope for the best for Świątek, and we'll bring you up to date if we have an update when we reconvene on Sunday night after Rome is finished. And who knows, Elena Rybakina might be holding the trophy at the end of this tournament, because she's still in it. She's taking on Yelena Ostapenko, who, as we said, let me down by not producing in Madrid when I predicted her to reach the semi-finals, and now she's absolutely flying. But I do feel somewhat better now that I know that we're all rubbish.
It has been peak Ostapenko this week in Rome. And when I say peak Ostapenko, I mean mad. Because there was a match against Krejcikova where she lost 16 points in a row and won the set. I mean, I honestly think she's the only person capable of doing that. It was extraordinary. She was not in the match and then suddenly turned it around and then won 28 out of 31 points in the middle of that match to beat Krejcikova. Wow. She was awesome. She was awesome in the first set against Paola Badosa. She hit 16 ground stroke winners and Paola Badosa had hit none in that opening set. It was just crazy. You know, given her serve, given her movement, I think you have to have amazing ground strokes. And she does. When they're sort of calibrated, it's incredible to watch. And she also blitzed Daria Kasatkina 6-love in the third set. She's been playing some unbelievable tennis at times this week. And it's her first clay court semi-final since she won Roland Garros in 2017, which is another peak mad Yelena Ostapenko stat. But her against Rybakina, sign me up, because that is great ball striking.
Yeah, sure is. Look forward to that. The other semi-final is going to be Veronika Kudermetova against Angelina Kalinina, who had the most extraordinary win over Beatriz Haddad-Meier a couple of days ago. I mean, they were going for nearly 4 hours, weren't they? And they both exited the court in tears. It was a really moving match because, you know, they'd put each other through it. And obviously, you know, there's so much effort physically that goes into those sort of matches, but also emotionally, even within them, Matt, because both players looked like they were going to win at various points and then it went the other way.
Yes, exactly. Longest match of the year on the WTA Tour, 3 hours, 42 minutes. Yeah, both in tears afterwards. I think, you know, it was a difficult match to play. It was a very difficult match to lose. The momentum was swinging back and forth. It looked like Kalinina would win the first set and Haddad-Meier mounted an incredible comeback. And then Haddad-Meier was up in the final set and Kalinina reeled off 6 straight games to win. She said a sort of fascinating thing that she couldn't feel her body or her legs afterwards. She never really thought she would have to play a 3 hour, 45 minute match. She's not really trained for that. So it, in a way, it's sort of shown her what her limits are and that they're much higher than she thought. You know, I think she'd only played about a 2.5 hour match before, and now here she was going an hour more than that. And an extraordinary effort from her. And she now plays Kudermetova, who has quite quietly, I think, reached back-to-back semi-finals here in Madrid and Rome. Having not had a great season, she's suddenly really found her form, and it's a big opportunity for both players.
Yeah, and it does, of course, put another match together between a Russian player and a player from Ukraine, which is something that is going to happen a lot on the tennis tour, and is another situation that we have in the semifinals.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. So that's where we are up to in Rome, in the tennis on court. And just before we conclude this edition of what is going to be a bit of a bumper edition of the tennis podcast, but I'm sure you understand that that we've had a lot to get through. And we very much wanted to include this because just a couple of days ago, I had a chance to speak to our good friend Christopher Clary from the New York Times. He's been covering tennis for that publication for more than three decades now with the greatest of distinction. And well, he had some news to share on Twitter, and it has a Rafael Nadal slant. So what's happening?
Well, David, I guess, you know, if you're a journalist and you can't have your own scoop, there's a problem. You got to be able to keep your own news close to your vest, I suppose. That's kind of part of the skill set required. But I'm leaving the New York Times staff. I've been working for the paper for over 30 years. The New York Times and the International Herald Tribune, which used to be its international arm, you know, based in Paris. And yeah, it's a big leap for me, and it's been coming for a while, but it's still pretty daunting when you actually do it, and pretty emotional, I have to say. Yeah, I'm heading out to become a full-time author and I'm going to write my next book on Rafael Nadal called The Warrior. And I'm going to be doing some work on Substack as well to support that endeavor and have a direct connection with readers. And I'll be posting some new material about tennis. The publication is going to be called Tennis and Beyond, and it's starting right now. So anybody who's listening who likes my work or is interested in tennis, come on over and take a look. But it's definitely exciting times for me, but a little scary, David, a little scary. I guess it's good to be a little scared at this stage in life, right?
Absolutely right. Well, I can guarantee you've got three subscribers right here from the Tennis Podcast, Matt, Catherine and myself. And I suspect you'll have many of our listeners as well wanting to follow your work because they've enjoyed your contributions on our show and more specifically reading your work for 30 plus years. One of your tweets, Chris, said that you think you've done 6,000 stories over the course of time. That's an extraordinary amount of work. Are there stories within that number that will stay with you as you move into this next phase of your career?
You know, that is tricky. You know, that really is. I'm not sure it's a good thing, David, as I was telling you before, to have written 6,000 of anything, but that's what I've done. And I actually know that because they have a database you can look at with the New York Times and the IHT, which was the acronym for the International Herald Tribune. You can see how many bylines you've had, and I'm past 6,000. So that's just do the math, which was never my strong point, which is why I partly became a sports writer. But That's a lot. That's a lot every year. It's a couple hundred a year for 30 plus years. And you know, so many, I'm not sure the stories stand out as much as I would say is just sort of the experiences and, you know, things like for me being married to a French woman and covering Roland Garros all these years, especially the early years when you're doing it for the first times, how emotional and sort of gratifying that is. And covering the 98 World Cup in football, soccer, with the French team and Zidane coming through and winning that and just seeing how it transformed the country for a bit. And, you know, more recently, just kind of having a chance through the New York Times calling card to be able to be ahead of the news and get a chance to meet some of these great athletes as they're becoming superstars. So a story recently that really sticks out for me was going to Alicante and spending time in Vienna at the Academy with Juan Carlos Ferrero and Carlos Alcaraz in December 2021. And just sort of knowing how good he could be was just so clear, but not knowing how fast that would happen or how he'd manage that. And then sort of to be there just chatting with him with nobody much around at the Academy and he and Ferrero in a backcourt. And then, you know, a few months later, there he is at the US Open handling all the pressure, playing brilliantly and taking the world by storm. So it's, those are the moments that are special to have been a little bit ahead of the curve, I think. And been very fortunate. You know, part of it's making the right choice. There have been times when I've, you know, written stories that sadly haven't turned out that way. I remember spending a lot of time with a young American talent named Cece Bellis early in her career, and such a young woman of promise and talent and drive and day-to-day joy, but you know, her body just couldn't take high-level tennis. So wasn't able to fulfill that tennis promise. I'm sure she'll fulfill many other things. So, but when you get a chance to go early on, and that's really the chance I got with Federer and with Nadal as well. And part of the reason why I wanted to write these books is because I feel like I've been there for at least a lot of their, almost all their professional journey. And that's a real great seat to be in.
Mm. We'll come on to talk about the book that you are going to be writing and what else you hope to do down the track. But just in terms of your own career, I mean, having spanned 30 years, I guess you've seen a lot of changes, both in terms of the way you are required to work as a journalist generally, and also the way tennis allows you to work. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that's a great point. Great question, David. It was funny yesterday. I'm actually in San Diego right now where my parents live, and we're spending part of the year here in support of them. And I walked out of the house knowing this was going to happen, knowing I was going to be saying goodbye. And I walked past somebody's front lawn, and there was a newspaper printed, wrapped up on the front doorstep, you know, the Sunday New York Times it was. And it was just funny to see it. It almost felt out of context to see that still in this era, you know, with all the, as digital as it's all become. And of course, when I started as a journalist, I started in San Diego at the paper here, the Daily, back in the mid 80s. And that was all it was. I mean, I remember I delivered the paper on a bicycle, tossed it like a American baseball player, not with much accuracy, unfortunately, but onto the front porches of people on my paper route. And so I had a direct connection to the business I would enter from that way of doing it, and made a fair bit of money, you know, for taking girls out on dates and whatever you like in high school from doing that. And when I started in the business, I remember being in press rooms and seeing older colleagues dictating their stories. They had a line installed in the press centers or press rows at considerable expense, with a rotary dial, and they would rotary dial a number and call the recording room, and they would dictate their game story from the tennis or the soccer or whatever it was. So the press room was a sound of cacophonous, often very eloquent voices dictating their stories, or very stressed out voices dictating their stories. And I was still writing on something resembling a typewriter back in the day. And here we are just on MacBook Airs, dictating some of our stories to our computers. And soon enough, unfortunately, AI may be writing some of those stories for us too. Who knows? But it's been pretty dizzying at times, the pace of the change from the print era and those newspapers filling up almost every house on every block, physical newspapers, to the internet era, to the social media era, to the AI era that is going to start right about now. So we're adaptable things, adaptable beings as humans, but we've been pushed here lately.
Mm. And what about tennis? What is it like to work in now compared to what it was? Obviously, the names and the faces have changed, but what about the working techniques?
Well, and some things are superior, obviously, with social media and you know, podcasts like yours and all kinds of sort of coverage from all different corners of the world. You can see players as they're emerging from wherever they may be. Somebody just posts a little bit of video and of a talented player in any country, and you can get a look at them, what they're doing. They're clips of so many more matches. You can watch Tennis Channel here in the U.S. And watch almost every significant match, either online or on your screen. That's all great. As a tennis writer covering it, definitely trickier for a couple of main reasons. One is that obviously with social media, the athletes themselves have taken command of their own messages, which is fair enough, but tough for people who are, you know, on the journalistic side, who used to be the conduits for news and the conduits for big announcements. Remember Roger Federer calling me up back in the day when he wanted to get the word out that he had mononucleosis. Not that he wanted to have an excuse, but he wanted people to understand, you know, what had happened, why his results had dipped, and people were, you know, talking about him being in decline, and he wanted to at least explain the full story. And now he'd put it on Instagram or post a video message. But back in the day, he called the New York Times. He called me. So that sort of news gathering has really changed. Still happens, but it's much, much rarer and much, much harder to get really in-depth time face-to-face with the biggest stars in tennis. It's all very micromanaged by their agents. That was always somewhat the case, but when the news media was the main way of reaching the public, those opportunities were, seems to me, a lot more frequent. And when you did get the time, it was a lot more in-depth. Now it's, you know, it's very hard to, and the New York Times, because of the name and because of the reach, still has had a lot of chance to sit down with those types of athletes, superstars, and get that close-up access. But even so, it's not as in-depth as it used to be and not as frequent. And I think, you know, also, even in, I think you and I might have been discussing this in Indian Wells a little bit, just sort of the, for me, the degeneration of the press conference and the devolution of the press conference. A lot of, as a tennis writer, what you do is you go to press conferences and you're working in there. And I can honestly recall, like when Steffi Graf would win a title, or in my early years, or Chris Evert, and there'd be these sort of long, involved back and forth with the press, with Evert or Graf or whoever it was. And it would just be, they'd break down the match. It would just be, talk about the ins and outs, the tactics. You'd kind of go almost in a format through each set, each sort of big moment in the match. And it was really great to sort of get the stars' analysis of how that match had proceeded. And now that's almost all gone. You hardly ever do that. It's all about sort of the peripheral things or the next match. I feel like I have a major now in writing about the next match instead of about the match that just happened, because so much of that has already taken place on social media, and I think in an inferior way. So I miss that part of it. But, you know, that whole line about nostalgia ain't what it used to be. It doesn't satisfy anybody, and it certainly doesn't do me any justice. Sound like I'm an old fogey complaining about the way things are. It's like everything, there's some good and there's some bad. But I sure do miss those kind of meeting of the minds that those press conferences used to be. And part of the reason they aren't that way anymore is because so many folks with different agendas are all in there trying to do different things. Not just print journalists trying to write a thorough newspaper story. It's also because there's much less time than there used to be. It used to be 30, 35 minutes of that. Now it's 10 minutes. And also because, you know, the athletes are going to save their best stuff for their own social media feeds.
Why do they need tennis journalists? Why are tennis journalists, why does it matter? If players can get their messages out there and tournaments can, some listeners, some viewers, some readers may think, well, and players may think, well, we don't need them. We don't need journalists. Why do we need journalists?
Well, the point of journalism for me is to try to get as close to the truth as you can. And no offense to the players, but they're presenting their very best side in a PR mode. I mean, a player's Twitter account or Instagram account is public relations, just in a new way. And so that's what it is. And, you know, more power to them. But if that's your sole source of news, I mean, would you make your vote and work in politics based only on Barack Obama's Twitter feed? definitely not. You need to have a different perspective and try to have journalists or at least somebody who's objectively trying to verify things, see if they're true or not, and to bring in the whole picture. So there's that aspect of it. The search for the truth requires somebody objectively trying to search for the truth, I think. Do you ever get there entirely? Maybe not, but at least you're trying. And two, I think it's for the ideas. You take a look at a day's play at a Grand Slam, you can go 100 different directions, as you know, with what you choose to present. But I think a good journalist is going to have a great idea for how to present that day and or to present that story that came along, and is going to have, you know, great people to be able to contact to make it a better story and a better tale worth listening to. So I think that's it. I think it's the search for the truth and it's the quality of the ideas. And obviously, I personally love great writing. A lot of tennis players are good at telling you what their news is, but they aren't going to write it in some beautiful fashion usually. Players Tribune does some of that for them, channeling their voices. But generally, I think I love good metaphor, lyrical writing, and journalists can provide that too.
Mm. Well, you don't actually need to tell me any of that, Chris, because I agree with every word you said. But it is really interesting to get your take on what's been. Now, what about what's coming up? You mentioned another book. You mentioned it's Rafael Nadal. The last one was Roger Federer. I suppose it's no great surprise that his old rival is your next source of focus.
I feel like at this point, much like it was with Roger when I started the process of researching and getting ready to write, it just felt like there enough had happened and that enough of the main body of work was done that it was a good moment to start that process and to be able to draw some really good definitive conclusions. And I think if you wait too long, I imagine much like I'm not sure when Roger will do this or if he'll do this, I imagine he'll do an autobiography at some point. Nadal has already done one early in his career. I think it was 2009. He hasn't updated it yet, but I'm sure he will. So there's also a window for us, you know, journalists trying to write independently. If you wait too long, I think you run into that obstacle of the players, you know, rightfully summing up their own careers that way. And, you know, biography in whatever form it is shouldn't be that. You're not trying to, you know, give somebody's own version of events. You're trying to look at it from a lot of different viewpoints and sum it up. And there's nothing beats being able to write freely, David. I mean, so much of what we see today is as told to memoirs and stuff that's highly vetted, highly supervised, a lot of huge amount of subject control from those being written about. You know, the master was totally independent as needed to be for a New York Times writer, and this book with Rafa on Rafa, sorry, will be the same. I mean, I'm leaving the New York Times, but I'm still an independent journalist, and this book will be written in that spirit. But I just think he's a source of fascination. It's been really interesting to see how I think there was ambivalence about Rafa earlier in his career. A lot of that's gone away. He's become a really, really popular figure around the world, in much the way that Roger is, and that linkage is very real. He has such a phenomenal mentality, and he's shown such phenomenal consistency mentally over the course of his career that I really want to explore that and look at that. I had the good fortune to follow Roger from a pretty early time in his career and had a lot of consistent interaction with him. And I haven't had as much with Rafa, but I've had a lot. So I look forward to bringing that to bear and diving into his story.
You mentioned you've had a fair amount of interaction with him over the years. And I imagine that's going to inform the way that you write this. I mean, I remember one of the features of the Master was you were able to use all the interviews you'd done over the years as the base for it without having that constricting element of his buy-in in real time, I imagine, and therefore the need to give approval. Is the plan to do a similar type of job? And if so, based on all the experiences you've had with Rafa, what sort of guy is he? What sort of guy did you get to know?
Well, David, that is a great question. And it's almost too great a question. I'm not going to get too much into detail because I don't want to give away everything by any means, because I'm still processing some of that stuff. All I can say is that, you know, I think the structure's not going to be a classic biography. I don't want it to be that. I think that Nadal's autobiography covered a lot of good ground and did it well. And I think in the Master, I wrote a big thick chapter about the Nadal-Federer rivalry and got into a lot of that as well. But I want it to be fun for me and fun for the readers and original. So I won't go into how I'm going to do that, but it won't be a classic biography. And my experience with Rafa was from the very beginning. You know, I was lucky because my Spanish was pretty good in the early years when I was living in Sevilla. I lived in Sevilla for about 8 years. And when he emerged on the scene, I was just coming to the end of that. So my Spanish was at whatever peak it ever hit. It was right around that time. And it never was pretty, but it got the job done. So I got to interview him in Spanish, and most of our interviews through the years have been in Spanish. So you see a different side of Rafa through that. And, you know, he is an authentic, gentlemanly character in many ways, but he's got a lot to him, a lot of meat. So, and I think honestly, more of that comes out in Spanish than it does when he's doing English interviews.
Mm. So it's going to be called The Warrior. It's going to be out in 2024. Does that mean when we're not going to hear much from you while you get your head down in order to produce that? And therefore, how does the Substack come in that you're going to start writing for?
Well, and this is for me a learning curve as well. This is a new structure and configuration for me. So I'm not entirely sure how it's all going to go. But my plan is I'm going to start writing for the Substack regularly right away. Hope to do a few things from Roland Garros. This is not going to be a daily thing, nor do I think people really want that at this point. They have plenty of other sources, but I'm hoping to bring my experience and my perspective and my ideas, as we talked about, to bear there on different topics. A lot of tennis, a few other things too. It's tennis and beyond. I chose that title for that reason. I like to be able to tennis be the main thing, but branch out now and then. And then as I get into the manuscript, I mentioned this in the initial post on Substack today, that obviously the volume is going to fluctuate when I'm in deep into a manuscript. I'm not going to be, you know, writing 3 or 4 times a week for Substack. It wouldn't be fair to the book project and wouldn't be good for my thought process. So, but I intend to keep contributing to it on a regular basis in some fashion throughout. And then hopefully, you know, going forward in 2024, love to be able to contribute to the Times again in some fashion, but Substack will be hopefully the main source for people who want to keep up with my writing, and definitely want to do a lot around the majors. And I have so many ideas I haven't written. So I'm looking forward to executing those in hopefully original ways on that platform.
Well, I, for one, very much look forward to reading them, following them, reading your books. And I will miss you day to day in the New York Times, I got to say. But at the same time, it sounds like you're not going to be a stranger. So that's good for me too.
Yeah, David. I mean, and I think all of us are, it's a very fluid time, you know, in journalism and media and the way news is covered. So interesting, I'm sure, for you with the podcast, is figure out, you know, new ways to use it and to expand your reach with it. And I'm kind of going to try to do the same thing in terms of more from a print basis, which is my strength, obviously. Try to use my words and my perspective in some original ways. But I really love the book. The Master was really a joyride. I feel very fortunate. I know a lot of writers don't feel that way about when the books come out, doesn't go the way they had hoped. That thing surpassed my expectations. And a lot of it has to do with Roger Federer. People just have a good feeling with him, and they want to connect with him, and they want to know more about him. And I just got lucky having, through the New York Times and the Herald Tribune, had all that time with him. So I think I really would like to have more feelings like that and give a lot to a project and have it keep on giving. I mean, I've been talking about that book and sharing it with people around the world for a couple of years now. And it's amazing to me that people still want to talk about it, but they do.
That's great. Well, we wish you the very best of luck, Chris. Thank you for all the time you've given us over the last few years as well on the Tennis Podcast, and the very best of luck with all of it.
Thanks, David. You guys are doing great work. So it's been a pleasure to be part of it in some small way.
Sort of bittersweet, isn't it, Matt? Because we love spending time with Chris Clary from the New York Times. It's like one of the cool things about being on the tennis circuit in the media room is we get to rub shoulders with the New York Times tennis man, who is just an absolutely great human being. But also, I don't know, I think he's the best of the lot as a writer. I mean, we've got loads of great writers and journalists in tennis, but to me, he is the best. And a thoroughly nice fellow as well. But he's staying in the sport. He's going to have his Substack blog. And he's going to be writing a Rafael Nadal book. Pretty good timing.
Yeah, no, it certainly is good timing. I cannot wait to read that book on Rafael Nadal, because, you know, his book on Federer is the book on Federer, I think. And Chris brings so much of his own reporting to that book, and I'm sure he will on Nadal as well, as he told you. And yeah, I mean, 30 years with one organization and leaving with a book contract in your pocket is a great run, and pretty much as good as it gets. But yeah, I hope he's still around in press rooms, because he's such an important man to have around. He's been incredibly kind to me as a young reporter in that press room. I will never forget he did an interview in pitch black with me during the Davis Cup Finals in Madrid in 2019, because I spoke to him there about the new tournament, and while we were recording, the lights just went out in this room that we were in, and he just carried on like an absolute pro, sat in the pitch dark with someone that he'd never met before, and gave me such time and such insight. And I've seen him do that with a lot of people as well, just sort of provide some background, provide some knowledge. He's just a wise man and a wise tennis voice. And we've been lucky to have him for 30 years in the New York Times. I'm excited to have signed up to his Substack, and can't wait to read his book.
Same. Okay, Matt, I think we better go to bed, because this really has been a bumper edition of the Tennis Podcast. We were not expecting this. We were planning.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I'm going to record mid-afternoon, shortly after Rafael Nadal told us he was going to play Roland Garros. Didn't turn out like that. Anyway, so we'll sign off with reminding you of our own mascots, the lovely Maisie for me, Xenia for Catherine, Darwin for Matt, Billie Jean, who is having the loveliest of time with Catherine's brother over the course of these few weeks, is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Hannah, Jamie and Drew. Thanks, folks. Couldn't do it without you. And we're going to save shout-outs until Catherine's return. That's it for this edition of the show. We'll be back again on Sunday night. Thanks for your company, and we'll speak to you soon.